Hi there, welcome to the latest edition of The Front Page. This week we'll be looking at why Cheltenham Festival tickets are selling slower than usual, why it appears many British jumps races are being run quicker than usual, and why the European Pattern Committee said no, or perhaps not, to two British upgrade requests. My name is Lee Mottershead, and the people to the left of me are called Maddie Playle and James Stevens. Hello to you both. Maddie, I'll go second with you because I saw you over the weekend, so I know partly how your weekend went. James, I've got no idea what you did.
I went to a gig in Bristol, had a very good time, and enjoyed watching a good day for the West Country at Ascot as well. So,
okay,
yeah,
you good. Went to a gig?
Yes.
Music?
A country music gig in Bristol.
Country music.
Oh, I love gig. That. Yeah.
Jordan Davis is very good.
Is he? Yeah, Kenny good. Rogers?
Oh yeah, like Kenny Rogers, more modern stuff. But yeah, no, very good.
Okay. I did a circuits class on Thursday, just two of us. And normally the instructor pumps out sort of modern, loud sort of bang music. But this time
you've shown your age a little bit there, Liam, I'm afraid.
But he plays country.
Does he?
Modern country.
Oh, right.
So, you know, you're doing your goblet squats to a bit of modern country music.
I don't even know what a goblet squat is. I'm not sure I want to know.
No, you might have ruined the experience for me now, thinking you're doing a goblet squat, Lee, I'm afraid. But there you go.
Don't need to discuss goblet squats here today, to be fair. Maddie, we were at Ascot together on Saturday. James referenced a good day for the West Country at the weekend. Did you enjoy yourself?
Yeah, of course. It was great. Interesting reaction to Lompressé's run, but we shouldn't take away from Pick Doherty, who was an exceptional winner of the Ascot Chase for Harry Cobden, who is now marching on and odds on to win the Jockeys' Championship. And Paul Nicholls as well. They had a double with 3 under 3.52. So Grand National clues, Cheltenham clues maybe, and some very good horse racing.
Yep. You won't, however, see Pick Doherty at the Cheltenham Festival. He heads to Aintree. And perhaps you won't see as many people at the Cheltenham Festival as Cheltenham and the Jockey Club would have liked. Explaining why is James Stevens.
So Ian Renton told the Racing Post on Sunday that tickets for the Cheltenham Festival are behind where it's been in the past, which is obviously concerning for the sport, given the Cheltenham Festival is the big shop window and so important to the Jockey Club finances. Gold Cup is on the verge of selling out, Ian Renton said yesterday, but it's still quite a long way behind where it had been in the past. Cheltenham Gold Cup Day around sort of the New Year, Christmas time, would sometimes sell out. Last year, January the 28th, Cheltenham Racecourse tweeted that Gold Cup Day had sold out. It's expected to sell out officially this week. And it's a worry because there's a lot of issues in the sport at the moment, one of which is the popularity. And I suppose the easiest, simplest way to judge how popular a sport is by how many people want to go and watch it. And if Cheltenham is not getting that same attendance, then that's obviously a key worry. Just to go through a few numbers for you. Cheltenham was so popular 2 years ago, they had to put a cap on at 68,500. So the success of Cheltenham is hard to judge. There's different ways of looking at it. But last year, it was only 87.8% full. Now, the reason that's important is because 33,000 people didn't attend. And I've worked out, if you say an average of £70 they spend on tickets and food and drink, that's £2.3 million that the Jockey Club have not had in turnover. In context, that's more than the prize money offered on the first 2 days. This is a big amount of people we're talking. Now, Ian Renton said yesterday that he has total confidence the crowds would be back. The cost of living crisis was blamed last year, as well as railway strikes and teacher strikes. And he said that there was a pattern across Jockey Club racecourses that racegoers were waiting nearer the time to book their tickets, and said that was certainly the case here. Whether that's true, I think we can never quite know what people are going to do. Cheltenham's a different one, as we've discussed this morning. It's in the midweek. A lot of people travel to Cheltenham. They stay in accommodation. They plan it in advance. So whether Cheltenham is different to other meetings, it clearly is. So what happens between now and the Cheltenham Festival in terms of his ticket sales is interesting. But from the sport perspective, if Cheltenham is not regularly attracting the big crowds it usually does, then it's a worrying time.
Yeah, it is a worrying time, particularly because, as you said, James, the numbers last year were significantly down, sort of 40,000 people down across the meeting.
But that is worth saying that was compared to last year when that cap wasn't in place. So
absolutely, although it was only on the Gold Cup day that the cap was a factor, because the numbers on the first 3 days were nowhere near the cap. Excuses and, you know, good excuses were given last year. Train strike, Teacher strikes obviously impacts parents. The cost of living crisis. So there were good reasons why the numbers might be down, but they were significantly down. You referenced that line that Ian Renton said about he had total confidence spectator levels would rebound this year. And he said that following the 2023 festival. That doesn't appear to be happening with the numbers at the minute not great compared to last year, which was already a bad year. And the point that you make, James, is crucial about the finance of this. Cheltenham is so important commercially to the Jockey Club. If the festival isn't making what it normally makes or what they would want it to make, that's a big concern. I suppose that the overarching question we've got to ask Maddie is why? You know, why do we think fewer people went to the festival last year and fewer people again seem to be buying tickets for the sport's top 4 days, 4 days that dominate jump racing and for a long time have been painted as untouchable, really, in terms of their power and success?
Exactly. I was one of the people who actually didn't go to the Cheltenham Festival at all last year. I've been for as long as I can remember, and it just so happened I just didn't go, ended up working, watching from home, missed out on that magnificent day with Honeysuckle and Constitution Hill. So that was a bit of a sickener. But I think, ultimately, we've spoken about it before on this show, is the quality of the experience you get at home versus on track. I think that plays into a lot of people's minds, particularly combined with the expensive cost of food and drink, of entry at least. The fact that, you know, you'll be searched, you can't bring food in with you, things like that. And it's a big commitment for a lot of people to book accommodation, for instance, if you're travelling a long way. And even if you're not, trains are really expensive. We saw last year with the train strikes as well. It's just not a particularly pleasant experience to get in and out of a race course for one day only. And then if you are staying down for a bit longer for the week, that's going to set you back a lot of money, as James will know, living in the area. So I think price definitely and experience. A lot of people don't like particularly big crowds, and although the crowds have been down, that's, you know, you hear a lot of more seasoned racegoers saying that they prefer slightly quieter meetings, you know, there's less pressure on the facilities and that sort of thing. I think all of those things are a factor, but this is still a huge concern because racing should easily be able to settle its best event, you know, its flagship meeting, the best of the best. Isn't this just proof that we really do not want a five-day Cheltenham Festival, which is what was mooted not so long ago? I think we know that, you know, the tickets will be bought, for instance, when it comes to Gold Cup Day, but that doesn't mean that we can't learn from the fact that they're selling at a slower rate. And I think we just need to wait and see how the population field sizes turn up for this year's Cheltenham Festival.
I think Maddie makes a really good point about the year you didn't go, because this, from speaking to racegoers who both in Cheltenham and just people who enjoy racing, one of the key things was COVID, in that a lot of people, they missed Cheltenham for the first year, and that was such a big thing. I mean, I've been reading one of Alistair Down's books where he talks about Cheltenham and its parish, and the way Alistair writes about people who go to Cheltenham and to suddenly miss it and break, oh, I've been going for Cheltenham for 30 years until blank, and they had that experience from home. I think it's made a lot of people rethink what that experience is like. And for a lot of people, I think that has taken that sort of, I cannot go a day without being at Cheltenham, has just been tested a little bit more. And I think from a sporting perspective, you've got to look at this year's meeting and say, what is it that's going to draw you there? Because the champion hurdle is essentially the same two horses we saw last year with nine lengths between them. Same to be said, really, for the champion chase. And the Gold Cup, it seems as if Gallop and Deschamps will probably win again. So the sort of appeal of the puzzle to work out seems a bit more straightforward. And as Chris Cook always talks about, the meeting has become a lot more predictable. There are a lot more odds on favourites. There are a lot more things that seem to be in place. And from a punter's perspective, I don't see this year that same, oh my God, I cannot wait for that race. What a hell of a draw. I don't think it's quite got it this year.
All I'll say, I agree with you on that, by the way. I think this year's Cheltenham Festival might be lacking in a bit of depth, or it certainly looks that way so far. Could do with the delve into the statistics. But all I would say is, it didn't impact the Dublin Racing Festival,
did it? No, that's true.
You know, short price favourites there, incredibly small fields, not particularly competitive racing, if we're honest, yet people flock to Dublin in their droves. and had a really good time and didn't have to, you know, pay a fortune to do so. Whereas at Cheltenham, I don't think you can say the same.
Yeah, I mean, I would still be one of those people that absolutely adores the Cheltenham Festival. I am massively excited about the 4 days. I accept everything that you said about the meeting is now more predictable than it used to be, that there is some repetition from last year's races, and that there is domination from the Willie Mullins stable and from Ireland in general, which might affect British interest in the meeting. But I think the numbers side of it is for me the key factor. You look at social media, people regularly talk about the cost of going racing, not just in relation to the Cheltenham Festival. We have seen a lot of British jumps meetings this season post really disappointing numbers, only 5,000 people at Newbury on Super Saturday.
Yeah,
that's not super. If you look at the cost of going to the festival, I was having a look on the website yesterday, I think it's £112 if you want to buy a ticket now for the Tuesday of the meeting, which is a lot of money when you look at what you could have paid to go to the Dublin Racing Festival. Now, against that, if I want, I go to theatre a lot, if I want to buy a West End theatre ticket, the price of those has soared in recent years. You know, what used to be the price of a very good stall seat will now get you the back of the stalls or in the dress circle. You know, you're paying a lot more for that. So it's not just the Cheltenham Festival and racing that has increased in price, but when you add in the fact that accommodation in Cheltenham is now massively more expensive than it used to be. You know, since COVID, numbers have soared again for the price of what you pay for a hotel or a B&B room.
I mean, it's not just that, it's extortionate. I had a look this morning, 4 nights, about 1,800 quid. That's just ludicrous.
In a relatively normal business hotel.
In a Holiday Inn sort of branch. Yeah. That's just ludicrous. That's, you think all you could get for that, and I've said it in the studio before, I've seen people talking to people have said, oh, we're going to go to Spain to watch the Cheltenham Festival because we can get an all-inclusive, and for that money, you could get something pretty nice for that sort of price.
So, exactly. Yeah. I think the thing that is a big factor, and I'd re-stress the point that you made, James, about how vital this is commercially to the jockey club, the Cheltenham Festival brings in the punters and the pounds. And I wonder, Maddie, you referenced that this highlights why a 5-day festival was a bad idea, and fair play to the jockey club for having abandoned any thought of doing that. They were right to do so. But I do wonder if this trend continues this year and we see numbers down on the disappointing numbers of last year, whether it might fuel some momentum towards changing the festival from a Tuesday to Friday meeting to a Wednesday to Saturday meeting. Perhaps they might think that a Saturday would do better than one of the other three midweek days. The Friday's doing well already, it's Gold Cup day. Move.
But then it's going to have to compete with so many other sports
potentially,
on a Saturday, isn't it?
Bad for ITV.
You look at, you know, what happened to the Derby and how that sort of lost its identity being moved. A lot of people still sort of lament that all these years on. So I wouldn't say that is necessarily the solution to all of Cheltenham's ills in this case.
No, I'm not sure it is a solution, but I wouldn't be surprised if they look at it. But what they will know when they know from the 4-day debate is any big decision taken about the Cheltenham Festival has to, you've really got to think about it. It's too precious a thing to take risks with. So yeah, it will be fascinating, won't it, to see how the numbers eventually pan out. I think we were talking earlier on about how this discussion now about how people, they're saying people are booking later for these sort of meetings. But of course, post-COVID, the line was that everyone was booking sooner because they had to.
Well, certainly from my experience, you can't afford to book later. By this time of year, usually everything's sold out and gone.
Yeah, the early bird tickets is quite a draw. I mean, the prices rise from when you book earlier in the season to later on before Christmas, of early December, I think, is the first sort of early bird point for Cheltenham Festival tickets. So, I mean, I really hope that people in the next few weeks book those tickets up and Cheltenham is busy. But whether that will happen to the same extent it happens for, say, meetings on a Saturday and weekend meetings, as it probably Jockey Club main fixtures are, I'm not quite sure. But hopefully it does, because it's good to have a big Cheltenham crowd. And I think the other final point on this as well is, when Cheltenham's busy and it's vibrant and it feels good and it feels cool and trendy and the place to be, that's good, because that has a knock-on effect. I mean, people forget that sport in this country is, we're such open to so many different sports. We watch NFL when the Super Bowl's on, and the darts when it's the World Championships. Cheltenham's our time to strike. You know, it's the time to attract crowds. It's the time to get people talking about racing, and it needs to be as good as possible. And for people there to be enjoying it and saying, this is good, come racing, because that's what will make those other midweek meetings that perhaps do struggle, that's what will draw people to them.
Excellent point, and a fascinating debate. We'll see what happens in March. What has been happening through this season, in the opinion of Harry Fry and Aidan Coleman, is that jumps races in Britain are being run harder and faster than ever before. I reference this because this was the subject for my latest Monday column, a conversation with Harry Fry a couple of weeks ago sparked my interest. Harry referenced a 2.5 mile handicap hurdle stage at Chepstow in mid-January on heavy ground. There were 12 runners, only 4 finished. The other runners were all pulled up. Harry says he believes that was because the early pace was so strong. You look at the race on the Racing Post website, and a reminder that all replays are now on the app as well. If you look at that, you will see that they did go incredibly hard early on in the race. He also referenced a 2.5 mile beginner's chase at Aintree in December. 4 runners, again, 1 finisher, 3 were pulled up. Harry's view is that races are being run harder and faster than ever before from an earlier stage. And he draws a distinction between what happens in Britain and what happens in Ireland, where generally, he says, the tempo of races is slower. He believes this is bad for the development of horses, of young horses, because he thinks it happens as well in novice and maiden races. He says it takes longer for horses to get over their races. And he even suggests it might be reason why there is one of the reasons why Ireland is doing so well relative to Britain. Aidan Coleman supported Harry's theory. He says it's something that's been happening for a while now. Races, again, been running faster from the start than ever before. And he also spoke about how that is changing jockeyship in general. And just to use a line here, quote a line that Aidan said, he said, I'm not sure how much jockeyship is now involved in being a jockey. You sometimes wonder why you're going so fast in a race and then hear another jockey saying, I'm just doing as I was told. You might as well use a £7 claim in a handicap if you're going to tell a professional jockey what they have to do and where they have to do it. His view is that generally speaking, trainers are telling jockeys that they want their horses to be ridden forward and prominently in races, and that jockeys are less likely to be criticised by connections if they are, say, prominent and in contention throughout in a race and then fade, compared to if they've ridden off the pace and then get there too late. He also believes that one reason could be that jockeys are more prone to social media abuse if they get there too late, as opposed to getting there too soon. It's something I hadn't really thought about before, but seemingly from what the guys say, it's a widely held view and could stem from the fact that trainers have a view that their horses are going to the races incredibly fit and they want to make use of that. But the reality in modern jump racing is that most horses go to the races incredibly fit. We're not going back to the era are when Martin Pipe and Michael Dickinson's horses were massively fitter than those of their rivals. Aidan and Harry think this is a genuine problem for British jump racing. It surprised me, Maddie. Did it surprise you?
Not particularly, in that I've heard that train of thought before, but perhaps the way in which it was spoken about. I remember reading Ruby Walsh's autobiography, I'm pretty sure, and in there he sort of outlined the differences between races and how they're run in Britain versus Ireland. Of course, he was hopping over the Irish Sea to ride for Paul Nicholls and then back to ride for Willie Mullins back in the day. And he would often say that Irish races are run much slower and it will be the cardinal sin to get there too soon. The polar opposite now seems to be happening in the UK, in that everyone wants to be prominent, and it doesn't matter if you're there on the scene too soon. You know, the last thing that somebody wants is a horse to fly home late and not get there. Whereas in Ireland, that's a lot preferable to making all the running and then get tired and tailing off. It's really interesting that Harry's the trainer who spoke about this, and I think Jonathan Burke's previously been quoted on it as well, who obviously rides a lot for Harry. We were at Ascot, as you said, on Saturday, and I think the final race was an example of jockeyship and perhaps not following the crowd. It was won by the favourite Anno Power for Harry Fry, ridden by Jonathan Burke. But I would urge anyone who hasn't seen it to go back and watch that replay, because she was very keen, held up, smuggled into the race and came with a really powerful late run. And to me, that was the highlight of how races should be ridden and can be ridden. And it's exciting, it's absorbing to watch. And you don't get that sort of sour taste in your mouth when you've got horses clambering over the final obstacles. Admittedly, this was bumper. But I think definitely there used to be a bit more of a maybe a consensus view with how to approach a race, whereas these days it seems everyone wants to be in the same position. I watched with interest, look, on Sunday yesterday, and Jamie Moore was talking about when he won his Champion Chase on Cider Grugy, and Richard Johnson turned and said, well, where do you want to be? And he sort of thought, round the inner, you know, sit prominent. And Richard said, go on then, you can have that spot. And then later on in the race, Jamie gestured to Ruby and sort of said, do I go now or do I go later in the race? And that sort of insight I found really interesting. But it just proves that a lot of these decisions and talking points we wouldn't necessarily be privy to as journalists. And now that's obviously extending to owners as well and how they want their horses to be positioned and races to be run. So really interesting discussion, actually. And I wonder if this is something that's been brought up by the PAJA, or at least, you know, the jockeys have had conversations about.
Yeah. And I suppose ultimately it's only really jockeys that can actually do anything to change it. James, not everyone will agree with this theory and argument that's been put forward by Harry and Aidan. And clearly, in terms of the battle between Britain and Ireland and Ireland's supremacy, it could only ever be one factor in a much wider, bigger issue. But I found what they said to be really persuasive and interesting. And they're involved in the sport. Aidan currently sidelined, but he rides in races. He knows how races are being ridden. And it surely is logical that if young horses are having hard races early in their lives, that probably isn't necessarily a great thing for them, right at the infancy of their careers.
Yeah, that's true. And to extend it to any horse that has to run on ground that is that testing, as you mentioned in that race at Chepstow. And I think the meeting at Aintree at the start of December, Beecher Chase Day was another one, wasn't it? Yeah. Where the ground was so testing and they went so fast. When horses finish that tired, it takes a long, long time to get over that run. And I mean, look, you can go back to the wider context of British racing. Well, if horses are finishing tireder, they're running less, so field sizes are down. So that's obviously a key worry. Yeah, I mean, I think the concept that Harry Fry said of the last man standing is as Maddie pointed to, I mean, it isn't as exciting, is it? You sort of watching horses and whoever's still there at the end is not as absorbing to watch as you rightly say. Racing is a sport, sports to entertain. Look, I think there's a couple of things I thought from this. One underlying theme I got was doubt, in that the way that jockeys are going hard, thinking that they mentioned race fitness and horses being. I also think there's part of that is thinking the other horses aren't very good, because you look at the novices' races over here and the quality of a novice. To win a novice hurdle here, you can be considerably weaker than to win a novice hurdle in Ireland. So I imagine there's quite a lot of jockeys that turn up and think, you know what, we think we've got the best horse in the race, let's ride prominent, and if there's anything better, then we'll wait and see.
Sounds like the Ascot Chase on Saturday, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And I think that almost that subconscious idea that the quality of these races aren't as good as they should be, I think that possibly creeps into the mind of people. Well, let's just sit prominent. We think we're on the best horse. Mm-hmm. We'll ride it like we're in the best race. So perhaps there's a sign of that, because in Ireland, you know, every race is really competitive. You have to get it right, because there's going to be something. There's going to be good runners, even if it's not Willie Mullins. You've got a Gordon Elliott horse or a Henry de Bromhead. All those sort of races, there's good horses in there. So you have to be on your game a little bit. I did think that. And the other thing I did think is sometimes sport does have fashion, doesn't it? There's ways of playing a sport or trying to find a bit of an edge. And at the moment, it seems, and for a while at least, this to be prominent has been quite fashionable. This is what the jockeys tend to be doing. But it'll only take one who just sits prominent, maybe beats them right at the end, and then all the jockeys are scratching their head thinking, you know what, maybe I should do that. And that might be how it changes. And it might be that this column has changed it as well. So, yeah, and the final point I think I wanted to make as well was the social media one. I think that's really interesting. I mean, to have a sports person going about their business differently because of a fear of social media is absolutely bizarre. Well, it's not surprising, but it's quite scary at the same time, because social media has its so many issues. And I mean, this is wider than racing. You know, you can say what you want and have no consequences. But I think from a PGA perspective, that's definitely something they need to look. And I'm sure they're completely aware of the pressure of social media, as everyone is in racing, because that is so worrying. And for young people who grow up with social media and may want to use social media to more advance their careers, you know, it's a way of it's a sort of an angle and a niche that a lot of jockeys might think, you know what, let's try that. To then be a barrage of abuse, you know.
Just to actually reference what Aidan said there, just to quote him, I also wonder, he says, if social media has something to do with it. If you ride a horse positively or aggressively, the social media backlash will be minimal compared to if you drop a horse out and ride a patient race. I think social media can stop jockeys being jockeys.
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it? The underlying thing there is that the jockeys are thinking, if I ride patient and don't get there and get beat, I'm going to look like I'm a cheat. That's the thing, and that's not the case at all. And people who understand racing know that's not the case, but they are worried about what people say on social media, which is just staggering, really, isn't it?
There was actually a point that Harry made as well in relation to not cheating and such, but he made the point that if you look at a race where a jockey drops a horse right out and then doesn't quite get there, the stewards might well haul that jockey in and argue that that was an injudicious ride. You don't really hear of stewards hauling jockeys in because they've gone too hard too soon.
Yeah, it's interesting, all of this, isn't it? I noticed, actually, I don't know why I stumbled upon it, but midweek, Cam Hardy sort of a long time, I think it was around Christmas time or something, tweeted that he was taking a leave from social media purely because the abuse that he'd gotten was too much. Now, that's very, you know, I feel for him, but also incredibly sensible to go, actually, I'm going to recognise that this is damaging to me and how I'm operating, so I'm going to take a step back. The other thing I would say, and this ties in with the Cheltenham discussions we were having earlier, you know, obviously the focus is hugely on Cheltenham throughout the jump season. Look at how many horses actually win from off the pace at Cheltenham. It wouldn't be too many, would it? I mean, you see the likes of, you know, Charlie Deutsch and Bryony Frost, they're usually incredibly positive. And Harry Cobden, another. And I wonder if that's slightly playing into people's minds, maybe, is that, you know, when the pressure is on a big day, you've got to be incredibly positive, because some tracks, you know, to almost bat against what they were saying, that's the way that some tracks ride. You need to be positive because it can be so difficult to make up ground from the rear. But, I mean, Harry and Aidan have a lot more experience of talking through tactics than myself, but I do think that's an interesting thing, and we'll have to see how it plays out at the festival as well, because it's certainly a trend that everyone seems to have recognised these days, is that prominent racers at Cheltenham do incredibly well.
Yes, agree. And I think Harry and Aidan, I think both their wish was that by raising the subject, it might get people thinking and talking about it, and let's hope it does. Any race, of course, can be reviewed on the Racing Post app now, with race replays available for you to study and utilise. Welcome back to the Front Page, our final story now, and we're moving from jump racing to flat racing and to Maddie Playle.
We are indeed, Lee. We learned last week that two races were not going to be promoted to Group 1 level despite campaigning for the from the Flat Pattern Committee. In cases such as these, it has to go through the European Pattern Committee, and they could not support both the Long Distance Cup on British Champions Day and the City of York Stakes to be upgraded to a Group 1 level. There's been lots of conversation around Britain having its first 7-furlong Group 1 in recent years, and the Flat Pattern Committee and York indeed have put a lot into trying to make that happen. So sadly, we'll have to wait at least another year to see whether those races can be upgraded and that potential explored. Frustration from the flat pattern committee, because obviously we want races to be at their strongest and we want to champion British racing and it to be of the highest quality, and a Group 1 would be a great opportunity to do that. Must say York considerably more frustrated than Ascot in this case. Nick Smith from Ascot sort of said, well, listen, we know that we have a Group 1 calibre race due to the ratings that it's produced over the last couple of years. And we're going to keep clamouring for that to happen. But ultimately, if the quality of the race is there, the tag of it being a Group 1 doesn't concern us too much, which is not a view shared by York. Interestingly, the European Patent Committee Chairman Jason Morris actually cautioned that there was a worrying decline in ratings of European black type races. Now, the most significant change for this year is that the Prix Saint-Hilaire, which is a three-year-old filly race in France, has been downgraded to a Group 2. That hadn't satisfied the criteria it needed to remain a top race and therefore was downgraded. Interestingly, other races at potential risk of being downgraded are the Commonwealth Cup, which I thought was fascinating, given that that's a relatively new race.
Yeah, and it's been perceived to be a success.
Yes, and indeed, if you look at the statistics, on average, last year's was a particularly strong running, with Shaquille winning, of course, but these things are much more broader than that. And then the Temple Stakes and the Chester Bars were the two other races that were possibly at risk from downgrading. Now, you know, understandably, there's going to be a lot of frustration around this for York, because, you know, we've seen Kinross win that race for the last 2 years and he's a bona fide Group 1 horse. And I think, you know, we're seeing more and more of these intermediate horses emerge. Saying that, I do wonder, given the recent runnings of the likes of the Hungerford, the John O'Gaughan, other group races over 7 furlongs, they haven't been attracting huge fields. But we know that there is an opportunity for horses there who don't quite stay the mile, but equally, you know, are at their best beyond 6 furlongs. So it's going to be interesting to see how this one develops and whether they'll eventually get upgraded to Group 1 level. But that was the latest on the flat pattern committee last week.
Yeah, it's really interesting stuff. Again, lots of different things we can pluck out of this to debate. If we just look more at the general situation, Jason Morris's comments, I thought really hit the nail on the head when he talked about a worrying overall decline in the ratings of European black type races. He went on to talk about how the issue of high class smart horses being exported to other jurisdictions must be a factor. And the fact that this comes from the EPC, James, highlights that we shouldn't forget that is not just a British thing. Mm. Horses are leaving Ireland to go and race in Australia and the Middle East and California. They're leaving France. They're leaving lots of jurisdictions. It's a wider problem for European racing.
Yeah, I mean, the job of a patent committee is to have a patent which reflects the horse population, and clearly the population of top quality horses, this is the latest example of that, is, as he says, is in decline. Horses being sold and whatnot. We've got 42 races in Europe next year which are going to come under review. It's just a sign that the quality of racehorses in Europe, not just Britain and Ireland, as you rightly say, is worrying. And it's something that's worrying over jumps. It's clearly on the flat as well. I mean, the other key area I thought which was interesting as I watched a bit of a racing in the Middle East, that doesn't have a direct impact on what the European Patty Committee do with their races. But when there's these certain races around the world which are so more accessible than they were 50 years ago and the prize money is so much better, it's no surprise that British trainers and Irish trainers and trainers in Europe are looking at those races and going, well, we could go for the Group 3 in Britain, or we could go abroad and take our owners on a lovely trip and go for a lot more money. So that will have a knock-on effect, because that 110 rated horse is now not appearing in this race, it's going to the Middle East. So there's lots of different things at play. Yeah, I mean, the City of York Stakes, I mean, I always thought it would be the Hungerford which would be the first Group 1, but credit to York, who've just continued to put the money into that race.
Whereas Newbury didn't put Newbury the money into the Hungerford.
Nor did Goodwood with the Lennox Stakes. Yeah. It was sort of between those two for a long time, and York went, you know what, let's go and do it. And it's a shame for them that they've not been rewarded.
£500,000
on that money,
race.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
I think, I suppose, I look at it in two ways, in that because there's not a Group 1, people, horses end up in 7 furlong races, I always think. They sort of try a mile, yeah, they don't stay, or stay strongly at 6, and they end up in that sort of division. Whereas if there was a Group 1, I wonder whether the thinking would change a little bit more as to, right, we're going to go and target the City of York. That will be our long-term aim because that's a Group 1. But without the Group 1, they possibly can't do that, if that makes sense. Interesting, yeah.
It's often been the foray at the end of the season, hasn't it? That's been the chosen opportunity.
But then that's a lot of the time because that's about the ground, because it's soft and autumn. But no, it's interesting. Can't believe you've not mentioned the Sovereign Stakes at Salisbury.
It's gone.
There's only a few group races on my patch and I've lost one of them.
You've lost one.
Absolutely devastated, but yeah. Welcome. We've still got the Dick Pool, I suppose.
You've still got the Dick Pool and the Uphaven.
Yes. Yes.
And for Jeremy Martin at Salisbury was very good in talking about how he saw the bigger picture,
yes,
and wider. And in terms of the bigger picture, Maddie, I suppose what's important to stress here as well, and this was a point made by Ruth Quinn of the BHA, is that you can look at situations like this and you can say, oh, the City of York's been denied again, the Long Distance Cup has been denied again. In both instances, I think we can assume it was a French-led non, because obviously the City of York would clash with potentially the Maurice de Guise over 6.5, and then the Prix de Moulin over a mile. The Long Distance Cup potentially clashes with the Cadran and the Prix Royal Oak. And you might say, well, listen, why are we part of this European Pattern Committee when they're stopping us having a Group 1 that should be a Group 1? But the wider point is, if we weren't as part of a wider European family on this, there would be nothing, for example, to stop the French saying, well, we're going to stage a 5 million mile and a half Group 2 race in the same week as the Jumbot International. It gives us protection. It can be immensely frustrating at times, but it does give us protection.
Yeah, and that was something that Ruth referenced in saying that we are stronger together. And of course that's going to be the case when you're dealing with a relatively small pool of horses at the very highest level when it comes to these Group 1 races. All I would stress is, when you're talking about a body such as the Pattern, tiny tweaks and changes, they can sometimes seem insignificant or like they're not going to have a big impact, but they absolutely can, specifically when you're talking about these valuable group graded races. Moving one of them, you know, changes in prize money, we've seen how that impacts field sizes, etc. Getting rid of races, whether that necessarily lends itself to strengthening others. You make one small change and it really is going to have an impact. And as you say, I think we're in a much stronger position that, as sad as it is in this case, that they're not going to be promoted to Group 1 level, that we're not in an environment where races can just be promoted and demoted willy-nilly and without due consideration. So really, it's good that we have steps in place in order to assess how these races are performing and whether they merit any changes that may come their way.
Yeah, and fair play to York as well for stressing that they will continue to put prize money into the City of York, and they remain hopeful. And just one thing I would want to say, these Pattern races, the upgrades and downgrades, are all based on ratings and strict numbers. But as a point of principle, I never understood why the Prix St Hilaire, a leading race to the Prix de Diane, had Group 1 status. It always felt to me like running the Musidora as a Group 1 or the Nell Gwyn as a Group 1 seemed to make no sense. So whilst I don't wish ill on anybody, I am pleased that the Prix St Hilaire has been downgraded. A bit political there, but sorry. Before we go and decide who has this week's winning story, I wish to inform you about a great offer regarding free bets. OK, Okay, time to wrap things up now. And as ever, it is the job of the person in this chair to decide who has the winning story. Having given myself the winning story last week and regularly repeated that I have a guilt complex, I can't possibly give my own story the winning nod again this week, even though I think it's a really interesting subject, the pace of races over jumps in Britain. And I think Maddie, the whole patent story, the EPC story, the upgrades to Angry, the future of the City of York and the Long Distance Cup, again, tremendously important. But James, Cheltenham Festival is the biggest thing in British racing in many ways. And if
never fails, does it?
Never fails. But it is failing to sell tickets to the same level as it has in the past. And therefore, you have this week's winning story. Congratulations.
Good. Well, hopefully that will inspire some people to head to Cheltenham and buy their tickets, I hope.
And good luck renting out your spare room.
We're certainly going to try, yeah.
Good man. Thanks then to James Stevens and to Maddie Playl. Thank you to watching. We shall be back next week on the cusp of the Westminster debate on affordability checks and quite close to those 4 days in March as well. Until then, bye-bye.